Hello, can I speak to David?
David's right here.
This is David I'm speaking to?
Yep, you got that right.
Okay, David, I am recording you. Is that okay?
That's great. You can do that. That's perfect.
Okay, I have already introduced you as David Churchick.
My goodness, you actually pronounced my last name right. I'm forking it.
Okay, and you are a Linux user from Canada, right? Is it British Columbia?
Yes. Yeah, British Columbia.
Okay, and I have been trying to get in touch with you for some time now.
Yeah, we keep screwing up the SIP phones and things and blah. Anyway,
okay,
I'm here now.
I am finally glad to have you on the show. And how long have you been using Linux, David?
Oh, gosh, about 8 years or so, 9 years?
Eight or nine years.
Something like that, because I started when I went was after I graduated from high school, so, yeah.
Okay. And, but before that, were you a Windows user, or?
I was a boss hack, pretty much.
Okay. Now, what I'm curious about, go ahead.
X mode is cool.
Okay. What I'm curious about is really what brought you to Linux, or what got you to use Linux the first time.
Well, okay, it goes like this. I was sort of sitting and I was taking a bunch of computer programming classes, and we had to do a bunch of crap in Windows, but I wasn't very good at it, so I ended up doing a bunch of stuff in command line DOS mode, and then my teacher was like, telling me that I was stupid to be even trying to use graphical mode because I don't think that well, and he's like, you should try Linux. So, what's that? So he told me what it was, and then I went off and grabbed the CD, and at that time, LTTY wasn't on anyone's installer CDs, and SpeakUp hadn't been got working yet, so I had to go off and, actually, I sort of cheated. I went and bought the, back then we had German distribution. SUSE used to be quite popular, so I bought that thing because it had Braille support.
Okay.
Actually, I made the college buy it, but anyway, so yeah, it had Braille support, and then I used that for a bit, but once I got bootstrapped and figured out what I was doing, because you have to understand that I had no prior Unix experience.
Okay.
So I did the install, got stuck in a shell prompt, and I was like, what do I do now? So I started reading the DOS to Linux how-to and crap, and I got familiar with everything. And then I decided that since I actually knew what I was doing, I would go try, like, Slackware. So I decided to do that and learned a bunch of stuff, and I started switching to... Then someone told me about the Linux from Scratch project, so I decided, well, that's got to be a good way to learn about Unix, so I'm going to build myself that. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
and I've not mentioned it, and I'm sure it's obvious that to anybody that's hearing this now, when you mentioned Braille support and some of the things you did, that you're a blind Linux user.
Yet, I don't see a dang thing.
Okay. And you've been that way since birth, is that right?
Yep.
Okay, so, but you've been programming since high school, is that right?
A little bit before that, actually, because my mom had an old 486, so.
Okay.
You know, you screw around with all the basic crap, which I don't remember any of now because I've been doing so much other languages that's completely gone off the radar. But,
yeah.
You know.
Okay. Now, in addition to Linux from scratch, you use Gentoo, right?
I was helping them test, yes, but I think that since they have pretty well everything worked out, I might put that on my PowerPC box to help test, but portage is really annoying. Anyway.
Okay. Now, do you use Slackware anymore? You mentioned Slackware.
Yeah, I do. I have it on my, the mail server that I upgraded to Debian about 6 or 7 years ago, it's been sitting there, and it was running Slackware for a bit, but then I decided that I didn't want to do a lot of maintenance because it was just a server, so I dropped the Debian install on. But I might have to change that because it looks like SIP broke a few things on my server. So.
Yeah, yeah, you played around a lot with SIP when you and I were trying to connect while you were still in.
No, SIP broke things on my server, not SIP.
I'm sorry.
Not SIP. SIP. The unstable Debian.
Yeah, okay.
Worked some stuff while I didn't update.
Okay.
So I don't know, I might probably, well, I'll probably, what I'll probably do is either fix the busted update or, I don't know, I generally like to not have too much hand-holding this, so I generally fiddle with things. It doesn't matter what distribution I'm using, really, because by the time I get done with it, it doesn't look like anyone's distribution to start with.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that. As a, did you have a preference? Is there one distribution that is...
I usually go for ones that are easier to hack.
Okay.
Easier to mangle, because I like things a certain way, and I'm very picky if somebody wants to tell me that something works better a certain way. Like, for instance, Arch Linux has this annoying thing where if you close the lid on your laptop, it assumes that you want to log back in again. And since I usually work with my laptop lid closed, and then I just pop it open when I'm doing stuff, because I have no need to look through the display.
Yeah.
So if I'm just listening to something, I just flip the lid down so I don't have the display sucking power.
Yeah. That's probably just one example of ways that accessibility it is maybe an afterthought.
It is all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. People always skimp on accessibility. The way that it usually gets implemented is that, well, Gnome, for instance, doesn't even start accessibility until you log in. Unless you're on Solaris, because Sun doesn't bother to test. Basically, Sun wrote all the Orca stuff, and they don't bother to test on anything except Solaris these days. So, which basically is a big mess for people that are trying to use Linux kernels, like myself.
Yeah.
Linux kernels are better than any other kernels, from what I can tell.
Okay, now what is Orca? Because, I mean, that may mean...
That's the screen reader that comes with the GNOME desktop.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the... Supposedly, they're going to make it work with other toolkits, but it's basically a big mess.
Oh.
So I don't know how far we'll get with that.
Is GNOME the Orca... Is it so tied into GNOME that you use GNOME as a desktop, or?
You pretty much have to, unfortunately, because it depends on some deprecated GNOME stuff that is no longer being used, but you still need it. And the problem is not so much that Orca requires the GNOME stuff, it's just that there's something called ATSPI, which is this, it's spelled AT-SPI. It's this Accessibility Technology Service Provider Infrastructure, I believe is what it stands for.
Is this part of GNOME too?
Yes, that's the real problem, because it is hooked into GNOME. Orca only depends on that and some other stuff, but the problem is that ATSPI is so stuck on GNOME that there's no way to remove the GNOME dependencies, so you end up installing a full desktop, even though I would be perfectly happy if I just had a terminal that could execute one or two GUI applications.
Yeah.
Actually, like one GUI application, because the only thing I really care about is like Firefox for getting at websites that absolutely require some weird scripting thingy.
Okay. Now, this Orca, the screen reader functionality, is it full functional? I mean...
Yeah, you can use it for pretty much everything. It's slow as hell, though, because... because right now, they're in the process of making it use Dbus to talk to everything. And so Dbus is already overloaded because everything on the system, including HAL and GNOME and KDE apps and whatever the heck else you may have running, is all using Dbus, right? Now they want Orca to use Dbus, and just so you're aware, every event that happens on a screen gets sent to Orca. So if you flip to another window, there's a focus change event that gets sent, there's, you know, an event saying that another window got popped up. There's about, like, I don't know, 10 or 20 events that happen just because you went to another window.
Wow.
And then if you press a key, there's a bunch of keyboard events that say that you pressed that the key got pressed down and then the key got released, and then that fires off some processing by ATSPI to see whether that was an Orca key, and if it was, then it does stuff. So basically what they're doing is they're hammering Dbus with thousands more events than they would have if they weren't using Dbus.
Ah.
And it basically means that if you ever get a D-bus crash, you'll take out the whole desktop and the screen reader and have absolutely no idea what's going on your machine, unless you have some sort of console access.
Wow. That does sound like it was retrofit.
Yeah, the problem is you got a bunch of sighted people designing access software that they don't depend on, so what ends up happening is they don't need to use it, so if it breaks, it's not a big deal.
Yeah, somebody
else. But the Pulse Audio people, they take the attitude that if your sound server dies, it's not critical. Well, if I'm sitting on a laptop and my sound server dies and I have no serial port on my laptop and no USB Braille display to hook up to the laptop, then I have no idea what just happened.
Yeah.
Because you just killed my sound server. So, I mean, people think about this stuff, but I always take the approach that no program should ever crash under any circumstances, and if it does, it's a bug somewhere.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we have some people who, they go, oh, it only crashes randomly, and we're not really sure, so we don't work to fix the bug. And so, this is the other reason why I use Linux, because the kernel is really stable and, you know, stuff doesn't crash.
Okay.
That, but you knew that.
Is there, do you use Linux because it is best suits your needs, you know?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because you can't customize every inch of a proprietary operating system. It's not possible. You can't decide that, oh, I don't want the configuration files to live there for whatever reason, or whatever.
I would imagine that there's a large amount of customization that you have to do when you install a distribution.
Oh, yeah, there's stacks, like, because most of the installers don't come with a screen reader, for one thing. So the first thing you end up doing is either installing Braille TTY, or my Braille display just crapped out, so I don't have that installed right now, but if you have a Braille display, that'll be the first thing you install. Then you have to make sure that you have screen access. It's getting a little easier if you decide to use GNOME, because the screen reader comes with GNOME, so distributions usually ship it.
Okay.
So that usually gets installed. But then, you know, if you want console access, you have to run SpeakUp or Braille TTY or something similar. Well, SpeakUp is fine, but it's a kernel patch, so you have to patch your kernel, and currently there's some bugs and speak up that you kind of don't really want to put it in your kernel if you can avoid it.
Wow. So, I mean,
but those are being fixed, so, you know, it's not too bad.
I can see why Linux from scratch would be an attractive distribution.
Well, yeah, because you're already hacking it up already.
Yeah.
So.
Now, you're obviously a very talented computer user. I mean, you're a programmer. I mean,
I should qualify that by saying that I haven't actually wrote any really large projects, because every time I go to write something, whatever I was going to write has already been written.
Yeah, yeah.
So there isn't much point. But that's not to say that I haven't hacked various bits of software, you know. I typically will build stuff from C, like if it's an application that I use often, like MPlayer, for instance, or you know, or Orca or whatever. If it's something that I use regularly, I just build it from the development tree, because I don't care if it breaks, because then I can fix it.
Okay.
And then I can report a bug or whatever. But
this won't be the first stupid question I'm going to ask, if it's not, you know, the second already.
Don't worry about it. There is no stupid question.
Oh, I'm not really worried about it, because I have a long history of this anyway. But
that's all right. You can always type your question in a receipt.
Yeah. But I guess I think what my question is, I mean, you're obviously, you know, an experienced Linux user, an experienced computer user, and you know your way around. Is there a distribution, Linux from scratch, any distribution you think of, that you as a sightless computer user can install without any hand-holding, for lack of a better term?
Pretty much. Most of them you can, as long as you can get a distribution. Well, like Arch, for instance, I needed to throw something on my laptop real quick, because our good friend Portage decided to break my package database on the laptop when I was testing Gentoo, so I didn't have time to compile Linux from scratch, so someone suggested that I try Arch Linux. Well, it turns out that their installed media doesn't have a screen reader on it, so what I had to do was I grabbed a GRML live CD, which is a, GRML is a Linux distribution for geeks, basically. It's a Debian derivative. It's a Debian live CD that has development tools, rescue tools, basically anything that you would need at a console, plus some like basic window managers and crap.
Does it stand for something?
No, it's a German word.
Okay, because I've never even heard of that one.
Well, no, you wouldn't. But if you go to grml.org, it's there. Okay. I only heard about it because someone on the speak-up list said they were using it.
Okay.
And I went, what the heck? I've never heard of that distribution, so I went and looked it up. But yeah, it's a rescue CD, so, and it fits on a USB stick. But you need, I think, a 2 gig USB stick for the full version, but they actually have 3 versions. Well, they actually have 4 versions if you count the 64-bit ones. They've got x86 and x86-64 versions, and they've got like a small and a medium and a large version. The small one is like 50 megabytes and doesn't include very much.
Okay.
And then the medium one's a little bit bigger, and then the large one is what I usually get, which has all the development tools and everything. So basically, if my laptop is completely hosed, I'm not completely hosed because I can pop this thing, and then it always comes with SpeakUp and Braille TTY, among other things.
Okay.
Because it's for geeks, so if you're not familiar with the command line, you probably don't want to bother. Because it'll boot up into a console, so if you're one of these people that has to have X working immediately, it might not be as friendly as, but it's got everything you're ever going to need. Like, you can, I use, when I get a blank hard disk, I put it in and build a system from it, so.
Okay, so would you consider it essential? I mean,
you got to have a rescue CD around, especially if you're blind. You got to have a rescue CD, because if something happens with your main box, like if your sound server crashed,
yeah,
and you have no idea what the heck happened,
you can at least
boot with the rescue CD and then figure out where you're at and look at the logs and go, oh, sound server crashed, all right.
Okay.
You ended up rebooting, but at least you've gotten yourself to a usable state and you can, you know, file a bug or you can do something because you knew what was going on. It's not like, you know. Or the other thing you can do is you can, the other thing it has, which I haven't seen a lot of live CDs have, the reason I was able to put Arch on the laptop that has no serial port, for instance, is because it has software speech, but the other thing it's got is that you can SSH into the live CD by just typing, there's a couple of things you can type at the boot prompt. One of them is you can tell it to start SSHD and put a password in. So that means that as soon as the thing is finished booting, you can SSH to that machine.
Okay.
Which is extremely useful, because then if you need to talk to some other box from somewhere, you know, you have an SSH thing, so it's cool. And then you can sit and work on your big box or whatever and not have to deal with the software speech on the laptop or whatever.
Okay.
If you're so inclined, but yeah.
Now,
more live CDs should do that. They should have like a little SSH thing. So if you can't actually start the installer with a screen reader, then you don't really care, because I've got 4 machines. So if it had an SSH server that I could start at boot time, then that would help.
Okay. Now,
and it's not something that's difficult to do either. You just have to. Because even my router runs Linux. I have OpenWRT on the router, so.
I think we mentioned this before, right? You and I, we've talked previously. Is that a Linksys or a Buffalo?
No, it's a Linksys.
Okay.
It's a WRT54GS.
Okay. Okay.
And it sits there and routes my traffic.
All right. Now, I was going to ask you a question that you've mentioned Debian, you've mentioned Slackware, Linux from scratch, GRML,
mm-hmm.
You've mentioned Arch. Are there any distributions that are just abysmal failures when it comes to
any distribution that doesn't have some text mode way of installing it is a failure.
Okay.
Because that way, even Fedora, for instance, they don't have SSH access, but they have a telnet install that you can do.
Okay.
So you can still get the text mode installer if you want to. I don't. I haven't actually fiddled with Fedora. I might though, but I haven't, because it seems that they're a rather large distribution for what I need. So
That's almost wild that they don't have SSH built in at the boot prompt, because I know even damn small Linux has that, I think.
Yeah, like most of them have, but what happens is most of the distributions, there's no way to get SSH access, like to punch in something on the bootloader's command line and get SSH access.
Yeah. I mean, it's cutting edge.
Because you can't tell when the machine's booted, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, unless it either plays a sound when it's booted or something, you don't know. So you just sit there and ping the box and wait until it's up or whatever, or, you know, punch in the SSH thing until it comes up. But, yeah. So, but, you know, in those distributions, if they could make themselves a lot more accessible if they just either came with a screen reader by default somehow. Like, Ubuntu does this, but they do it in a weird way. And you have to punch in about five or six things at boot prompt. Like, because they have this graphical boot menu, so you have to punch in a bunch of sequences of keystrokes, and it's kind of awkward.
Yeah.
You can make it work, but it's a real pain. They should just make it so that you can type something in at the boot prompt and have it do what you need.
Well, are things getting better with Linux in your age?
They're better than they were, but the problem is that we have now is that, the speak-up stuff is being fixed. They know where the problems are with that, and they're fixing them. The problem is it's got some issues now that have to deal with the kernel not having its own thread for speak-up, and so speak-up is sucking the CPU for, like, several milliseconds at a time and not letting processes have it.
Yeah.
But that is being worked on and going to be fixed. So that's better than it was, because there was a time for a while where you'd go and you'd grab the latest kernel and then you'd patch speak up and it wouldn't work, because the kernel people change stuff all the time. Like every other week, they've changed some kernel interface.
Yeah.
So what they're working on now is trying to get speak up into mainline, and if they do that, then it'll be easier to get people to have text mode access. As far as the GNOME stuff, there was a time when it looked really promising, but we're running into the same trouble that, you know, we can't seem to get the people to care enough about performance and stability to make it work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, the community, the accessibility need community, is it large enough to bring the attention that this needed? I mean, how does...
Well, I don't know. See, a lot of the speak-up users... Well, first of all, the problem with any GUI-oriented system is you attract people coming from Windows.
Yeah.
And Windows users of any denomination don't know anything about bug reports. They don't know anything about meaningful feedback. So the problem is that, you know, we have a large... And the other thing that you run into is there's a significant group of blind people that have... They've gone blind later in life. In fact, most blind people were born, like, with some sight or whatever, and then they went blind later in their life. And so, a lot of times you're having older people, some of them have multiple disabilities, and so you have this bunch of users who expect things to just work and don't give people feedback when it doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then you have a bunch of sighted people programming, like Orca, which they need to be there because obviously we can't read the screen if the screen reader's busted.
Yeah.
So you need to have people with working eyeballs, but they fall into the trap of, well, it works well enough, but they don't actually need to use it regularly.
Yeah.
So, you know, the extra performance, they don't understand that you want to have speech or braille feedback as quickly as you can get it.
Yeah, your performance needs are just like everybody else's.
Just like everyone else. You wouldn't like it if when you pressed a key, you had to wait 10 seconds before the impact of your key press showed up on the monitor.
Yep, exactly.
And that's what I'm getting sometimes when I use Orca. Like, you go to the... Because the way that screen readers work is you press keys to review certain parts of the screen. So somebody will say something on IRC and I'll be off in some other console and I'll hear what they said, but since then about five messages came in, and so I'm, you know, reviewing all these messages that came in on IRC. And so if I want a certain one, I'll hit one of the review keys, and it might take, you know, 5 or 10 seconds.
Wow.
before I actually hear this, whatever it was that I wanted to hear. And then if a bunch of events came in between the time that that key press got spoken, then they all get queued up and I get hammered with about, you know, a bunch of speech that I didn't necessarily want all at once.
Yeah.
It's, you know, what if it would just be responsive in the first place?
Now, is this something hard work and fix? I mean, can you, you know, I know
no,
hardware
it's not.
Fixing.
It's not. That's not a hardware thing, because the box that I'm seeing that issue on is a, it's you know, one of those dual core things. It's got, okay. It's an SMP box and it's got, you know, a couple of gigs of RAM.
So they say.
So, you know, it's not a hardware issue. I mean, unless you want to say that you need a quad core to run accessibility.
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is not slow. I usually, well, the reason that when I built it, I built it so
yeah,
I could have a fast
yeah.
box. I built it so I could have a fast box to build my LFS crap on. You know, I don't want it to take 40 minutes to build GCC, so
yeah.
It takes about 10, you know. So it's not that the box is slow, it's just that the way that the ATSBI and GNOME stuff is implemented.
Wow.
I've even heard you talk about that in general, about the GNOME stuff being slow before.
Yeah.
So, some of that's, I think what we're seeing is that accessibility is exacerbating a problem that's already there.
Okay.
Because what happens is anytime you have accessibility, you put a load on the system because you're sending info
yeah. All
the time somewhere else. And there's no way to disconnect the video card. So now, instead of just sending one set of infos, you're now sending two sets of information. So I think that's part of it. But it could be fixed a little better. If they would do some real-time programming or something, they probably could get it done. But the problem is that...
So installing a real-time kernel doesn't help the situation? Or
no, because if you can install real-time kernels, but unless somebody knows how to make the scheduler work
okay. Properly,
you know, you have to actually... Like Pulse Audio, for instance, knows about real-time stuff. So it's very responsive, but the problem isn't in the sound server. The problem is in the accessibility infrastructure.
Okay.
You know, it should really have a real-time thread. It should, which you could do that with the stock kernel. You actually don't need any special real-time things because the real-time stuff is already in the latest kernels, I believe.
Now, you've mentioned GNOME repeatedly, or GNOME, or how it one chooses to say.
I'm not really sure how you're supposed to say it. I think it's GNOME,
yeah.
But...
Yeah,
it's kind of awkward. So.
Yeah, it is. But you've not mentioned KDE.
Because they have no accessibility to speak of that I'm aware of.
That's. I want to use the word that surprises me. I guess it does. I mean, I just wonder how. I mean, they've been around longer than GNOME. I mean.
Yeah, you would think that they would, but as far as I know, there's no way to read a Qt application with a screen reader.
That's wild. I know they have, you know.
If it was up to me, I would be happy with something like, I was reading about window managers on Linux.com about a year ago, and they had an article on something called Ion, which is basically, from what the article said, it was basically a really minimalist window manager that had like almost no buttons, but you just did everything with the keyboard.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
And the only thing that starts up is like a little terminal.
Yeah.
Like, that would be perfect for me, because most of what I do is from a terminal anyway, except when I need to look at weird scripty bit websites, or, you know, if somebody came out with a... Well, I used LinFan a few times from the GUI just because I was lazy and I wanted to see if it worked.
Yeah.
But, and there's, you know, there's... But outside of that, you know, there's not really anything... But I really, because everything is so efficient from a shell, if you know what you're doing, there's not really much point in using anything else, really.
Yeah.
Unless you have to, for some reason.
But like yeah. LinFone, you said you've used it from a GUI.
Yeah, it has a console mode, but I just wanted to see if the GUI one worked with Orca, so.
Okay, so I mean, I guess what I don't understand is how Orca works. If... I mean, do you use a mouse with a GUI?
No, you use a keyboard.
You move the keyboard, and that moves the cursor, and if it mouse... Go ahead.
Well, what you do is, on the... Like, your screen reader has a review cursor, right?
Okay.
Which is a cursor that is sort of only... it doesn't actually do anything to the pointer on the screen. It's just the screen reader keeps track of where it thinks that you are on the screen.
Okay.
But it has nothing to do with... The way that Orca implements it, for instance, is everything on the screen is an object. So you're basically going through this object tree.
Oh.
Right? So, and then when you want to click on something, then there's a key on the keypad that you press that simulates the fact that you clicked your mouse there.
Okay.
It basically sends the click event to whatever program it was you're using.
Okay.
So, because I can't physically use a mouse for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Because you have no idea where exactly the pointer is.
Exactly.
So that's how they implement it. And of course, in text consoles, you don't really need a mouse.
Yeah.
Because everything is just, you know, so you just review the screen and, you know, you can, that's basically all you need. There's just commands. And they usually move them to, like, the numeric keypad because nothing else is using that, so.
Okay. What applications? I mean, you've mentioned Firefox. You've mentioned Orca, which I don't know if you call it an application or just a.
No, it is. It's a screen reader. Okay. It's required.
Okay. But what other applications? I'm not necessarily talking about just for, you know, for you to do your day-to-day computing, but the ones you can't live without for whatever reason.
Well, you can't live without mPlayer because it plays everything.
Yeah. You don't like VLC? Well, I guess VLC has a command line, doesn't it? A command line mode?
I don't know whether it does. I haven't tried it.
Okay.
I might do. I've gotten mPlayer to play pretty well everything, so
yeah.
That's just all I've used.
Yeah,
I mean, it
has a very rich command line that mPlayer does.
Yeah,
I'm
mean,
not
it,
sure about VLC myself.
You can basically make it do everything from the command line, including stuff like this videos and everything else.
Yeah.
So I like the fact that it lets you set the video output to null.
Okay.
So you're not wasting your CPU sending video to the video card when it's not really being useful to you.
Wow, I mean, that's just the one, you know, it's something I would never think of because that's just not part of my...
No, you would never use that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would use that because someone would send me like a, you know, some video or other that I want the audio from, but the picture is not helping me,
yeah.
So I just turn it off. But, yeah, so I use that. I use some, of course, you have to have a text mode web browser run, so I usually use e-links for that.
Okay.
And then I use NMH for getting my mail, which is the oldest mail system on the planet, I swear.
What is it again?
NMH.
NMH.
Yeah, the message handler.
Okay, so I don't know if I've heard of that one. Well, Debian used to install one that was began with an E. I'm showing my supreme ignorance right now.
Elm?
No, it wasn't Elm. It was,
It wasn't Elm?
No.
Email program?
It was an email handler. I don't know if it's EMH. I don't know.
It could be EMH. That's an Emacs front end for NMH, I believe.
Okay.
But I usually use VI, so.
Okay. Is VI what you grew up on, what you learned, or what?
Well, actually, I wasn't really sure. There was when I started using Linux, we had like, you know, Nano and Pico and those type of things.
Yeah.
And because I'm trying to write code, you don't really want to be doing that in Nano because it's kind of awkward. They don't have a lot of, well, for one thing, they don't make regex very easily exposable, so, and everybody likes regex, so.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to, basically we took a bunch of C++ stuff in school, which I didn't really learn very well because when I was in college, they didn't bother to give me the textbook in a form I could read.
Wow.
So I basically didn't get the degree that I was supposed to. You know, it was basically a mess. So what I ended up doing is I went online one day because I actually got kind of discouraged with programming and I just sort of left it after that experience. And then I found some software that it worked pretty well, but I decided I didn't quite like it. I was going to fix it, but I didn't know how to fix it because I didn't speak C or C++ or whatever. So I basically went to my friend and I said, can I get a CBRIC? And he said, yeah, you can get a CBRIC. And he hooked me up with a text copy of the K&R book, you know, the big original,
yeah.
You know, terse C-book.
Yeah, yeah.
Which assumes you already know how to program.
Yeah.
Good read, though, if you can manage it. It moves rather quickly, so you better be paying attention. But is that, and then he also found a book called Thinking in C++, which is available on them. So I grabbed those and I started hacking them stuff, and then I asked him, I said, well, where am I going to get a decent editor? I mean, surely there's got to be stacks of text editors for Unix, right? And so then I got into the whole VI and Emacs war, Pick one and see what you liked. And actually, I tried both of them for a bit, but I decided that I liked VI because you don't have to know Lisp to customize your editor.
It takes less fingers, too, is my experience.
Yeah, it does. Those Control X and Alt X and whatever combinations just about drove, especially if you type Dvorak, just about drove my hands crazy.
Yeah, and I've never messed with a Dvorak keyboard, but...
No, I did only because I have to type lots, because they don't, rail everything.
Yeah.
So I have to type lots, and I play the bagpipe as well, so I really don't want to bork my fingers.
Okay, we'll get to I'll ask you a question about the bagpipe in a minute. I think I learned on Emacs, because I think at the time when I started using Linux, it was Red Hat 3.9 or around there. I wonder if that was the default editor was Emacs.
No, not usually.
It may not have been. That's the one I ended up using. I don't know why, but it may just
be. What happened to me is that my friend is one of these people he was from the VI side of the editor flame war. The guy that gave me the C book and everything, he was like, well, you should learn VI, and I'll explain it to you. And so he basically just taught me how to use the thing.
Yeah.
And if you have somebody explain it to you, it's perfectly logical.
Yeah.
What bothers people is that nobody explains how it works to them.
Yeah.
People need to understand what it means to be in command mode and what it means to be in insert mode. But what I like about it is that VI or some clone of it is available everywhere.
That's
like
why.
I usually use Vim, but if I go to my router, I've got the same editor, even though it's running BusyBox.
Yeah.
I don't have to go and learn a bunch of new commands.
That's why I learned VI.
Every system's got it.
Yep.
Plus, it also teaches you things like ed and sed and stuff.
Yep.
Because they all use the same commands, so you're not having to learn, a stack of other things.
Yeah.
And it does everything you need. I mean, Vim has pretty well every editing feature that Emacs has, and probably some that Emacs had to write separate applications for.
Okay.
Because, I just use that because that works for me, and it's, nice and easy to hack. Configuration files, nice and easy to read, so I don't have to learn Lisp.
Okay, now you mentioned Orca being a screen reader, but what is the speech synthesis system you use?
Well, when I'm at home, I have a DoubleTalk LT, which is a hardware synthesizer that plugs into a serial port.
Okay.
And I like that because it speaks really quick.
Okay, now is that... Does that run Linux? Is that something that's like a...
No, it's just a box that... I don't even think it really has an operating system. It's basically, you send text out the serial port and it speaks it.
Okay.
And it's got some ROM that controls pronunciation and other things, but...
So that...
It's just a little box that you plug into a serial port that's got a speaker and a volume control.
Okay.
And a headphone jack, and you just flip the volume control on and...
Have you used any of the software solutions that come with Linux?
Yeah, I usually use eSpeak for the software synth because it's the most responsive of the software synth. It doesn't speak fast enough, but it's still...
Okay.
It's fast enough to be usable, but not as quick as I would like.
What, besides that one, what are some of the others?
There's like Festival and Flight and... I think there used to be Umbrella Voices as well. I'm not sure if those are kicking around still. But Festival is just too slow and too big to be useful.
Yeah.
But you knew that. It works great for what you're doing, because you're not actually using it for a screen reader.
Exactly. it's a novelty for me.
Yeah, well, it's cool because it's a nice human-sounding voice, but...
Yeah, I want to say that was the Umbrella voice, but it's not. I think it's one of the Arctic voices, I think is what it was.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
They sound kind of... But what I noticed is that when you get human-sounding voices, they suck more computer memory and they don't respond as quick.
Yeah.
So... When you're talking about daily use, I generally tend to go for speed before I'll go for pronunciation or other things, because as long as the pronunciation's consistent, you don't really care.
Yeah.
And DoublePod gets it right most of the time, and eSpeak gets it right most of the time, so...
Now, I would imagine that it's a lot like, you know, for sighted people, it's been shown that they can... And it may be the same with Braille, too. I have no idea, but I'm sure your fingers recognize letters like a lot like maybe some... This is complete ignorance on my part. Some people's eyes recognize words, but it's been shown you can leave a certain amount of letters out of a word, and the human eye can still... Or the brain can still recognize what the word is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, and... The way that Braille reading works is you actually end up reading every word twice, because you're moving your hands across the one... Like, you put both of your hands on, like, if you had a Braille book or a Braille display that was big enough. Usually this isn't so true of a Braille display, because you only have one line of Braille, and you're moving the controls on the Braille display to move the Braille line up and down the screen or whatever. But if you're reading a book, what you do is you put both of your hands... You don't actually read with your thumb or your little finger, because they're shorter and a little out of the way. They're not really in line with your other fingers.
Okay.
So you just use the other three fingers on your both your hands. And what usually happens is you start out reading with your right hand, and your left hand sort of follows behind it to keep track of what line you happen to be on. And then when you get to the end of the line, you just move your hands down and continue. So the side effect of that is that you end up reading every line twice, but over time you learn to ignore the output, the second bunch of output, unless you need it.
Yeah.
So if you read over a word and you didn't get it the first time, you'll get it the second time.
Okay.
Which means that it's extremely efficient, and you can read very quickly, and you know, like you say, if I leave out a couple of letters, well, you can pick it up fine.
I was going to ask you something. This is an extremely interesting conversation for me, and I'm listening and forgetting what I was going to ask you next.
Take notes.
Yeah, hard to do while I'm operating the steering wheel here.
You're supposed to take notes before you phoned.
Oh yeah, I did actually. I've got my index card in my hand.
Okay.
Screen reader. That's what I was going to ask you about. You said a Braille reader reads text one line at a time. Is that what you said?
The Braille display.
The Braille display.
Which is basically what it is. It's a line of... It's supposed to sit under your keyboard. Like, usually they'll have a line of a bunch of Braille cells, and then above that there'll be like a flat surface that you can put your keyboard on.
Uh-huh.
And so when you slide your hands off the keyboard, because... The one disadvantage of Braille over speech access is that you have to take your hands off the keyboard to read it.
And that's what that review key is for?
Well, that's why there's buttons on the Braille display, so you can move the display around the screen without taking your hands off the display.
Okay.
So, when you're using Braille, you don't have to reach up and hit the number pad keys on the keyboard to review stuff, because those usually control speech access, and then you control the Braille from the Braille display, because if you're going to move the Braille display around, you want to move your hands as close to it as possible, so it's quicker. That's why, like, IRC doesn't work so well if you've only got a Braille display. But you can do it, because Braille PTY is nice. It has a freeze feature that will make the Braille display keep the same screen image that it had and not bother to... It'll make Braille PTY not update what would be on the screen, so you have got time to go back and figure out what was there, and then you can unfreeze it when you want the new output. which means that you can... Because there was a time where I didn't actually have a hardware synthesizer, so I used Braille exclusively for about a year and a half.
Wow.
And I got actually quite good at it. But I'm still good at it, but it's just that my Braille display is gone. Because I like having a display for programming. It's much better. because I don't have to listen to stuff like in main left paren void right paren left brace int I semi.
When you say you have a display and you talked about freezing, that so it doesn't update. That's in essence a page.
Yeah, it's basically whatever a screen full of blurs.
Okay, so you could go back and review. I think that's what I was trying to grasp is.
Yeah.
A Braille reader or whatever term you use.
Yeah, if you have a Braille display, you can. But oddly enough, Braille TTY is the only screen reader I've seen that actually will let you freeze the output. Most of the other ones don't let you do that. But
I was wondering, other than a debugger, you know, how you would go back and review code that you had written. But I think I understand now.
You have review keys for speech and Braille that you can do that, and the review keys work all the time, so even if you weren't freezing the screen, you could still review stuff.
Okay.
It's just that the reason you freeze the Braille display is so that you don't have a bunch of, because the way that refreshable Braille works is your line of Braille is being refreshed in real time, just like your display is, except that it's Braille. Just like speech would be constantly reading the new stuff that came in, your Braille display would be getting updated constantly. So what that would mean is that as you were reading, if you're reading IRC and new stuff comes in, it refreshes right underneath your fingers the new stuff. Which, if which happens, of course. Well, you've seen scroll on IRC, right? It happens so quickly that you have to wait until it finishes it before you can properly read what's scrolling by, right? So that the same effect, of course, happens with Braille. You have to wait until it's finished.
Okay.
And then you can read it. Otherwise, it just sort of flips out from under your fingers.
Are there any? I'm going to have a hard time forming this question, I think. But are there any limitations, stuff you do every day, things that just don't work the way that you want them to? And what I'm thinking of is something, specifics like, I don't know, I guess because I can't think of something that is, I should just let you tell me, but...
No, but like Linux-specific stuff or
I was thinking, it's probably the stuff you have to get used to, but, screen readers and stuff. Like, if you're programming and you've got syntax highlighting
syntax highlighting is completely useless. You pretty much have to read, pretty much have to read it yourself. What is cool, though, is that, both Orca and SpeakUp will read indentation, which does help.
Okay.
But, yeah, syntax highlighting is kind of useless, really.
Yeah.
I guess what it should do if it finds errors is maybe it could beep or something.
Yeah. And see, I'm not a programmer.
That would be helpful.
To me, syntax highlighting is I guess, a reminder for a sight user, a visual reminder. You need a brace here.
Yeah, you didn't put a brace there, or you left out a parenthesis on this one, or you didn't put a semicolon or whatever, and it usually highlights the part that's the problem. But, if it's going to do that, it should flag it in some useful way.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it should... I could put something on your status, like on the bottom line of the screen, where it usually displays error messages when you go over that line. It could, because the screen reader will read that, because that part of the screen changed, so it could say, you screwed up here or something, or whatever it normally does, some sort of message that says there's an error. Python kind of does that, except that where it shows you where in the line there's an error, it doesn't actually... does it in some sort of visual way that I haven't been able to figure out, but they should definitely improve that somehow. I'm not really sure, because I've never actually seen syntax highlighting, so I'm sort of guessing at what it's supposed to do.
I sort of am too, because I'm not a programmer.
I've seen it, but you haven't needed to use it that much.
Yeah.
Doesn't it also highlight for shell script though?
Yeah, I think so.
You write shell script, don't you?
Yeah, but I usually...
Well,
I think it's something you have to actually cut, physically turn on in a configuration file, which I've never bothered to do. So.
Which you've never bothered to do because you think it's useless like me, yeah.
Well, or I'm just not advanced enough to actually need it because I don't write the super long ones or something. I don't know.
I
scratch an itch only when I need to.
Shell script is just so many, you know, command line. I don't really find syntax highlighting that useful anyway, because what ends up happening is if it doesn't compile, you know you got issues.
Yeah.
If it doesn't run, you know you got problems, and then you got to go. Well, sometimes it would be helpful if you had it, I guess, because then you're not doing like I am and looking around to find the line that was three lines up from the one that that actually has caused the error.
Nah.
The compilers are weird, but yeah, that's one thing that's completely useless. The other thing that's what I find annoying is when people, for whatever reason, decide they need a graphical bootloader. I hate that, because if you're booting a live CD, well, like Gentoo did this. They wanted me to test their new live CD that they just came out with. I don't know whether they fixed it or not. We filed a bug, but they were using the Grub bootloader.
I remember when they first went to that. It struck me as odd.
It's not obvious how it is that you're supposed to get Grub to let you edit a command line. Like, if you're using Lilo, which I usually have all my systems boot to, or, you know, SysLinux or whatever, it comes up and you get a thing that says boot colon, which I know that because I got the double talk to speak the boot messages that come up the serial port.
Yeah.
But, so you get a text command line, and you just type in your command line and wrap return, and off it goes. But Grub doesn't let you do that because it comes up with a boot menu, and you've got to select what you want and then figure out what entry you're going to edit. And, of course, you don't have a screen reader or an operating system loaded at this point, so you have no feedback at all. So, yeah, that's kind of annoying to you. They should just make it a rule that says that all bootloaders should have text command lines that you can just when they come up, and they should always beep too. People should put like a little beep in their bootloader configuration.
Yeah, because you mentioned earlier having to ping a box to tell when it's come up. You know, if you want.
Well, yeah, because you don't know if it beeps at you when the bootloader comes up, then you know, okay, it's ready for you to type an input, because you obviously can't read the boot colon thing that shows up on the screen unless you have a synthesizer plug-in, but then the bootloader needs to be told to send its messages out the serial port, which is going to be useless for most people because they don't have synthesizers stuck to their serial ports.
As a Linux user, how were, as far as the number of applications or the size of the repos or just the library, of programs that are available to you?
It's great, because as long as it works on the command line, you can use it.
Yeah.
Which is cool, because that's the problem with, like, different toolkits, is that different toolkits do things differently. And so you either have to have a screen reader for each toolkit, or you have to have a different way of getting the information from all the different GUI toolkits, but there's only one way of getting info from a text console.
Yeah.
There's a text console, and you can't really... I mean, it's just text.
Yeah.
So it's easy to, once you have a screen reader that can process text consoles, they all pretty much look the same. So, you know.
That still just blows my mind that KDE, that there's no screen reader.
You should get on them about that. You should say, hey, why don't you people have a screen reader? Because what should happen, ideally, I would like to see the day when you could just pick a window manager and run your application and not have to care.
Yeah, well, you could sit down in front of a computer, I mean, that somebody else's, you know.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, what I do right now is I just haul my laptop everywhere because, I don't need to worry about using someone else's machine.
Yeah.
I might steal their network cable, but... But, you know, that might be the limit of it. I don't have to care, because most people don't want a screen reader on the machine. Ideally, it should be, like, something similar to the way that Apple does it, where, you know, they do a lot of things badly, but one thing that they get right is that they include a screen reader that works with pretty well everything in the operating system, and you go up to the machine, and you hit a keystroke, and you get a screen reader.
Yeah.
So, you know...
Does Apple do it better than Windows?
Yeah, Windows. I mean, you can install OS X with a screen reader without needing any sighted help at all if you have to.
Wow. Didn't know that.
You can't even do that at all with Windows unless you get somebody to make you like an unattended installed disk and pray that it goes right. And the thing too with Windows is the screen reader doesn't come with the operating system, so you have to pay an extra like $1,000 to get a screen reading program. And it's just, and then you have to pay like maintenance fees to upgrade this. It's just a big mess.
Wow.
So
are there, and
it's not worth it because you can't hack the software to bits, so screw
it. Are there any specialized Linux distributions made specifically for sightless Linux?
There were at one time. I'm not sure if they were discontinued. If they were, I wouldn't use them anyway because I think that we should just include everybody.
Okay.
Like, there shouldn't need to be specialized distributions.
Yeah.
Because it's the whole discrimination thing. I mean, we're not any different than you or anyone else. I just have eyeballs that don't work.
Yeah.
It's not my fault. I didn't ask to be born that way. So I don't want anyone thinking they need, you know, some different device. All they should really have to do is make some device accessible. But, like, for instance, the simple thing that they could do is if you buy an MP3 player, it's already got a sound chip, so you could beep when your battery is getting low or something.
Yeah.
Instead of just flashing a light, it could beep when you flick it on or whatever. You know? And that's not even a major accessibility feature. All it would have to do is, like, you know, little clicks or beeps when you selected menu items so you knew where the heck you were.
Yeah.
Which is something that Rockbox gets right. They have talking menus.
Yeah, I've tried those out.
Which actually is kind of cool because that way you can make files that will speak your music files. My current player doesn't support it, but...
What is your current player, just out of curiosity?
It's one of those, it's a creative thing.
Okay.
Because it was the best sounding one I could find.
Okay.
I was trying to find one of the iAudio U3 ones, but I couldn't find one.
Yeah, I don't know. I think they still make them and sell them, but, and I think there's a beep feature, but I can't make it do anything. I mean, I cut it out myself.
Because, I don't know whether I told you this or not, but I'm probably, you might have guessed this already, but I'm somewhat of an audiophile, so...
Yeah, when you said you picked one that sounded the best, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of... All of my music that's on my computer is in Q6.log, because
wow.
I don't have enough disk space for FLAC, so I put it in Q6.log with this from my CDs.
Well, I've recently bumped my OG version of my podcast up to Q5, but I don't think it helps out.
For voice, it's not critically important.
Yeah.
For music, Q5 is decent, but Q6 is better stereo separation, basically. So if you're concerned about that, I am because I have an M-Audio Delta card in my big box at home. So.
Okay.
And I got these separate acoustic speakers that sound pretty good. They're not as... I don't believe in buying all this surround stuff because I just listen to music, so it's useless having a surround sound for music because there's only two channels anyway.
Yeah, I'm probably the exact opposite. I'm like an excessive personality person in some ways. When I was in college, my Volkswagen had 27 speakers, and
It does sound cool because you can't hear anything except music, and wherever you go, there is music, and it's very loud, and it's very cool.
But there's no stereo separation.
It doesn't help with audio quality.
No, not a bit.
No, so I would rather have, you know, two speakers, and you know, you have to have a subwoofer because the computer speakers are so small that they don't produce bass very well, so...
Okay. Speaking of music, I'm going to have to... I could talk to you for another hour, but then...
Yeah, you could.
Daycare would kick my kids out, and I would get in trouble. But the bagpipes, how long have you been playing those? Why did you start playing them?
Because it was a difficult instrument to try, and I like a challenge.
Okay.
So I thought... I played piano for a bit, and I discovered that classical piano music sometimes, so for some reason, has this hypnotic effect on me, so I just decided that I didn't want to go to sleep. I wanted to actually play the music, so. And of course, trouble with piano and other things is that you get these people, conservatory people that are, when you're talking about being obsessed, so I will say that these people are obsessed with music theory and they're not so interested in whether it sounds good. They're interested in whether it's played exactly as what's on the page.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you know anything about music, you don't always play exactly what's written because you're interested in playing about, you know, whatever kind of music you're dealing with, which means that you might have to add some expression or, you know, whatever, hold the note a little longer than it was written for. So the bagpipe stuff, there were tunes that have been written 4,000 years ago in some cases, so nobody gets to tell you how to play the music. Everybody memorizes the music, so because you can't hook a music stand to a bagpipe. Everybody should memorize their music, whatever instrument they're playing, but with a bagpipe it's required. And it's just a neat instrument. It's insanely difficult to play, and I like that.
Okay.
Because just when you think you've got it right, you haven't. You need to go work on it again. Which means that there's always something new to experiment with or play with or whatever. Now, that said, if it makes some sort of sound that could possibly be turned into music, I would be interested in playing it.
Now, what kind of music do you enjoy listening to? I mean, I would guess a large variety, but...
pretty much almost everything.
Okay.
Except for I think that rap should just have a C at the beginning and that, you know... Because I don't actually... I will say that it is an art form, but it's definitely not music.
Okay, yeah.
And I don't like the hip-hop type stuff for the same reason, because it's basically rap type things with a different drum machine and some extra synthesizers that are wasting computer memory, basically. I mean, if they would do something creative with the synthesizers, but every time you hear them, it's always this continuous music loop.
Yeah. The absolute best piece of rap music I ever heard in my entire life.
Yep.
I don't know if you'd call it rap or not, but I think it was whatever name he was choosing to use at the time, Sean Puff Daddy Combs.
Yep.
I saw it on Saturday Night Live, and it was Jimmy Page and an orchestra doing Kashmir with Sean Puff Daddy Combs with alternate lyrics that he was...
Are you serious?
Yes, I'm trying to think.
That would actually be cool. You mean the Led Zeppelin song, right?
Yes,
rap lyrics.
Yes.
That would have been weird.
It was great. It was this really aggressive, angry rap.
But that's because that song's got a bunch of cool guitar stuff. Jimmy Page is just... You could listen to it. I actually had somebody... Oh, what the heck was it? They had an album. It was just a bunch of guitar stuff that my friend had. And it was like Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton doing guitar stuff.
Oh, man.
And it was all like on the same album. And it was just a bunch of guitar instrumental stuff. It was crazy, man.
Yeah. So, I think the best part of that song, the Jimmy Page, Sean Puff Daddy Combs song, was the drums.
Who was drumming? Was it John Bonham or whatever his name is?
I don't think
the
it
guy
was.
From Led Zeppelin?
He may have been. I'm not sure, but I'll find a link or a recording.
I'd like to have heard that. Find a recording of that. That'd be interesting.
I've got it. You'll like it.
But yeah, I've been known to listen to pretty well everything.
Yeah.
And I have a weird, because I usually just put everything on random, like, here's a bunch of music and hit shuffle. So basically what you end up getting is you get stuff like it'll play some Pink Floyd thing and then it'll play some bagpipe solo.
And then
it'll go off and play just weird stuff.
Yeah.
It'll go off and play like some opera thing after that or something. So yeah, my music collection's sort of all over the map. I like Radio Paradise for that reason, because they play bits of everything.
Yes,
cool.
They do.
And I like the Virgin Radio Classic Rock stream because it's all about Q5 OG streaming.
Yeah, and that's why I like Stream Ripper. I can fire up Radio Paradise.
Yeah, that's cool. That song's coming on.
Yeah.
You just sort of rip it, and you don't really lose anything because it was streaming anyway.
Yep.
So.
Yep.
Yeah, that said, you know, you don't want to be converting your MP3s to OG files because it sounds like hell.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, it sounds like hell. Then sit down. Good boy.
Okay. I thought you were talking to me for a second.
No, I was telling Vince to...
Okay.
Telling Vince to sit on the floor here.
Vince is your dog.
That's my guide dog.
Okay. David,
he doesn't like bagpipe music.
Though. Oh, I bet not.
He hates it.
So he hasn't gotten used to it?
No, he hasn't.
Okay.
I'll have to send you a recording of it when I get back.
Yeah, do it.
I need to go find a good microphone. Have you got any good recommendations?
No.
I don't have a I have that USB one that I was talking to you on the,
I mean, just a good
but
cheap
microphone.
But I don't
have a good microphone.
A good cheap microphone. It's for vocal. I don't know about it, the audio. It's the Shure P38, or I probably get the number wrong.
Okay.
But
I'm going to go look, because the USB, Logitech USB one is good for, like, voice stuff, because it's, but anything over about 5 feet away, it starts to drop off in quality pretty good.
If you can send it. If you can send me something you don't mind people hearing, I'll put it at the end of this podcast. I mean, it's
yeah, cool. I'll do that. I can't do it now because I don't have my bagpipe here.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. I mean,
but when I get back, I can send you a recording.
Okay, yes, yeah, so I may not make it into this podcast. It may make it into the next.
Yeah, you can put. You're free to put my broadcast, my playing, whatever than that if you want.
Okay, cool, David.
I usually record my practice anyways.
Okay.
So one of the ways to tell whether you suck or not, just listen to it again.
Well, sometimes, with my case in podcasting, it hasn't helped me any, but...
No.
But I'm going to have to go now, but
I actually should make a podcast.
Yeah, you should.
But I don't know what to podcast about, though. Maybe I should just some random whatever podcast.
I would listen. I listen to anything.
Yeah. Well, I listen to just about anything, too, so
obviously,
I'd probably listen to
listen.
It.
It, was there anything, I have to go now, but was there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't?
I think you covered it pretty well.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll have to see what kind of comments you get.
Yeah, I'd like to have you on again. I don't think I've said that to anybody yet, but I think I could talk to you.
Anytime.
Okay.
Anytime, that's perfectly acceptable.
Okay.
I'll have to work out my SIP issues though.
Yeah, the whole Canada.
I think yeah, I think that the TalkShoe stuff ended up working eventually.
Okay.
But I couldn't talk to what's their name, the Asterisk server, so.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what's going on with that. I have to play with Asterisk yet. I haven't played with that yet, so I have to.
Yeah, and that's something I need to keep doing.
Fiddle with that, see what we can get to work. Shouldn't be too difficult, but we're going to see how far we get with that. But yeah, I should go look for a half-decent microphone. I found some decent headphones the other day, now I'm going to find a decent microphone.
I got me some, Sennheiser, is it a German?
Those are good, but
yeah.
I'm not a big earbud fan because earbuds are really uncomfortable if you wear them for long periods.
Yeah, and I don't wear mine for more than an hour, but I like them on the lawnmower because
they're uncomfortable if you have to wear them for a 4-hour flight. You know, the in-flight entertainment system sucks.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
You have to, you know. So I got these headphones that are, they just kind of clip onto the back of your ear. Well, yeah, and they sort of sit on top of your ear, which is nice because they don't squish your ear. I don't like the ear cup ones that squish your ear.
Yeah.
Because those aren't very fun.
But, David, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to go. I actually got a 10-year-old daughter outside the window of my car.
All right.
Well,
yeah, okay. Well, you can, there you go. You got a big slice of podcast recording, and if people want to listen to my crummy voice for another hour and a half, they can do that. That's fine.
This was very interesting and fascinating, and I thank you for your time, David.
Not a problem. Anytime.
Okay, we'll talk to you in IRC.
Okay, sure.
Okay, see you.
Oh, you might as well tell people what my nickname on IRC is in case they want to know who the heck this is.
Do you pronounce it Kajari?
I have no idea. I got it from a random name generator.
K-A-J-A-R-R-I, right?
K-A-J-A-R-I-I.
Okay.
Yeah, don't ask me how to pronounce it. I was tired of having people take my nickname on IRC, so I was just like, okay, we were guaranteed to have a random new nickname. We'll just go and get a random name generator and change a couple of the letters and actually how to do it, so.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to you in IRC.
Yeah, make sure your Arisi still works.
I know it. I have more time.
Sorry, I just had to bug you about
hey,
that.
No problem.
You're probably gonna make me say about it a bunch of times too.
This is maybe the first time you said it. Now, I love to hear Canadians say that.
Yeah, because you can't do it.
Yeah, I know I can't.
So, no, you can't.
My tongue doesn't work that way.
Well, my friend always gets annoyed when I call it a root or two.
Yeah.
I try not to call it that. But it's really pronounced root, but most people have to route their traffic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I doubt you read it up here. So, anyway, we'll catch you later.
David, thanks a lot.
Yep, no problem.
Talk to you later.
Okay,
bye.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.